The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This is the Peter Boyle Show.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody, on a Wednesday, March 17th. We're talking to Billy off air. It's like living in a Stephen King novel. Every time you think the monster's dead, it just comes straight back at you. 38 will be the high today, says the 710 KNUS Weather Center. 50 Thursday, 55 on Friday. It is St. Patrick's Day. Good morning, everyone. Great Irish historian Chris Klein with us, and it is time to find the best rate on your mortgage, and no further than American Financing. They're in it for you, creating custom loans designed around your goals, whether it's a lower rate, access to cash, new home purchases, once you've got that covered. And they did it for me last year. Legitimately, I simply made a phone call, and they took it from there. Saved me a bunch of bucks every month. They tighten up the time you owe. It's wise. There's no upfront fees. There's no hidden fees. They do it so straight. And today, like I said, a lot of folks are still laying out on the weather. American Financing, make the call this morning. American Financing today, 303-695-7000, 303-695-7000, 303-695-7000. American Financing, NMLS 182334, regulated by the Division of Real Estate. I feel as though I know him. I think this is my third book. Christopher Klein joins us. The book is When the Irish Invaded Canada, and it's an absolutely true story. Hey, Chris, good morning. Happy St. Pat's. Welcome back to Denver.
Peter, happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Thank you. What I promised you would do, so I'm setting you up, but the first part of the book, and I'm drawn to Irish history, and I want you to do sort of a setup lecture. But when Nicholas Breakspear, who is placed on the throne of St. Peter, becomes Pope Adrian, and he grants Henry II the divine blessing to invade the island in 1155. Ireland's been occupied. Take it from there, if you would.
Yeah, so the luck of the Irish really isn't something that you want to have for a good 700 to 800 years of history, but they have the poor fortune of being in the backyard of the British Empire. So they're occupied for 700 years, 600, when along come in the 1700s, what were called the penal laws, which were particularly harsh for Irish Catholics. So they've already had to endure centuries of occupation. But when the penal laws were passed in the 1700s, your rights as an Irish Catholic were severely restricted. So you could not freely worship. You could not have a Catholic school teacher come in to teach your kids or send them out to a Catholic school. You could not own a horse worth more than £5 or a firearm. Couldn't hold public office. You were allowed to have one knife in your house as long as it was chained down.
Yeah,
so you couldn't use it against the local police. And even in death, your rights were restricted because you couldn't have a priest preside over a graveside ceremony. So you have for a good 7 centuries, the Irish who managed that, even though that they are subjugated, they're not conquered. They're still able to maintain their culture, their language, their religion by sort of turning inward like a snake coiling itself for protection. But then in the 1840s, 1845, you then have the failure of the potato crop. And the potato crop had failed all across Europe. Actually, the potato blight had come from the United States. Potato crops failed in Maine. The reason it caused such a horrific consequence in Ireland is because the British system of economics, you could not, most of the land was owned by Protestant Irish or English tenant landlords. Irish weren't owning the land, and those who could couldn't pass them down in their whole plot to their next of kin, so that you were every generation getting a smaller and smaller plot of land, to the point that the only thing that you could grow in significant numbers and still survive were the potatoes. So there are some incredible stats that every time I put this in, editors cannot believe it, that the average male in Ireland was surviving on 12 pounds of potatoes a day. I mean, they were eating it for breakfast, lunch, dinner, everything. So when the potato crop fails in 1845, that's basically their staple. And at the same time, oats, barley, other crops that are being grown in Ireland are being exported by the British back to their port cities where the Industrial Revolution is taking off. So you have for the Irish who think that the English are trying to take away their language, religion, and culture. Mm-hmm. Now the potato crop fails and they think that they're trying to exterminate them altogether.
And the British actually think that's a good thing to have happen, too.
You do have British higher-ups in the government, particularly a man named Charles Trevelyan, mm-hmm. who believe that this is a godsend because Ireland is overpopulated, so this is the way to cull the population. Mm-hmm. You know, Winston Churchill had this
another
quote that's attributed to him that said that the English had always found the Irish a bit odd because it refused to be English. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the English are trying to remake the Irish in their own image. That's what they've been trying to do. And when the potato blight comes along, you have sort of that view of the Irish that permeates some of those in government. And then there's also a very laissez-faire attitude among what the response should be in the English government. Mm-hmm. Basically take a hands-off view to what's going on in Ireland and just want things to play out.
No, it's the time of social Darwinism and mm-hmm. the British lay back. And our guest is Christopher Klein. I'm just a geek about reading Irish history. This is as good as it comes. And what's interesting to me as a reader, and I've been to Ireland a couple of times and got relatives and stuff, but didn't they call it the Irish problem? Isn't that what they talked about in part? Yeah, and it's interesting because I was talking about the Wannsee meeting, and it was the solution to the Jewish problem. And history is this great wheel that turns and repeats. But how many Irish died, you think, in the hunger?
So there's an estimated 1 million die, and an estimated 2 million end up having to flee the country into exile, many of them then ending up in Canada and the United States. So you have an island that, before the potato blight, has about 8 million people. Mm-hmm. It's cut down almost in half by you know, what people tend to refer to now as the Great Hunger, not a famine, because there's still food being exported. Mm-hmm. Ireland still has not regained that population back, which is just stunning to think about.
I have,
you know, it's such a lasting scar.
My nephew lives in Boston. He says there's more Irish in Boston than there are in Ireland, which I think is a great line. It's probably true, too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure Dublin still is the largest Irish city in the world, mm-hmm. or, you know, more in New York and Boston. But, yeah, you really have these two different tracks then, where you have the Irish who remain after the Great Hunger, and then you have the Irish who come to America and are longing for their homeland, and in some ways are more patriotic in that way. I mean, St. Patrick's Day was a bigger event in America than it ever was in Ireland because of what happened during the Great Hunger.
I've read other people who say the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York was the first civil rights demonstration in America. Do you believe that?
Hmm. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, but
I can certainly see that as being the case. I mean, I think over 200 years for that St. Patrick's Day parade in New York. But really, after the Great Hunger, it changes in such a different way, because the Irish who fell in America initially, colonial times, early American history, tend to be more of the Scotch Irish, Protestant Irish, and then after the Great Hunger, completely different in terms of the demographic in Ireland that comes in here. And it is the poor Irish, you know, who donate the pennies to build St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, where, you know, the parade would go by every year. So I can certainly see that.
I'm trying to think of the historian who said that. I don't know if it was Cahill, but someone said that because of the treatment no Irish apply, that the St. Patrick's Day parade was the first civil rights demonstration in America. I don't know if it holds up, but it's a really good theory. The same thing is true, the role of the Catholic Church in Ireland during all of this, and the Catholic Church is complicit in, especially when, you know, when the rebels rise and they cannot be in consecrated ground. And that's what the church did to Al Capone, interestingly enough. He could not be buried in consecrated ground in Chicago. But if you were in young Ireland, and if you were in any of the rebel movements, the church excommunicated. The church needed its power, and they played with the crown.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's sort of a fascinating aspect of it. So that Young Ireland Revolution that happens in 1848 is an attempted revolution. It's a very secular movement. You have Catholics and Protestants. Yeah. It's very based on Irish culture and literature. And so it's a political movement as much of a military movement. And they don't get the support of the Catholic Church for one reason. You know, their status is threatened later on. You know, we'll probably get to this. So the members of the Fenian Brotherhood who launched this invasion of Canada, they form a secret oath-based organization. So because it was a secret organization, the Catholic Church considered it banned. And then the Pope, even 10 years after it was no longer a secret organization, still didn't believe it and ends up issuing an edict in 1871 that any members would be excommunicated from the church. So there is a great deal of tension between Irish revolutionaries and the Catholic Church.
Always.
And then when they come to America, the same dynamic is in play too, because a lot of the Young Ireland leaders, when the revolution fails, some of them will get arrested and transported to Australia and escape and come to America. Mm-hmm. Others will flee and come to America directly. But there's a lot of tension in New York City, in particular, between that Archbishop John Hughes and the revolutionaries coming to the city in the 1850s.
Christopher Klein's with us when the Irish invaded Canada. I'm with him because the same thing happens in the French Revolution. They go after the church again. But then comes a period that I've loved to read about. It's in the first part of 1848. Now, the French Revolution, the first republic or first attempt has happened. United States has happened. We're going to do a book on the air on Friday that I recommend to you. It's called The Craft, about the Masonic Brotherhood and the rise of the Masons and it border jumps into the Illuminati for a couple of seconds, but they overthrow Louis Philippe. And it's the Second Republic. This spreads across everywhere, across Europe. And these guys are modeling, looking at the U.S. too. And that springs in Ireland. Talk about that.
So you have a lot of inspiration from the United States model back in Ireland. I mean, you look at the United States casting off British rule, which is exactly what the Irish want to do as well. But that revolutionary fever that's sweeping Europe at the same time certainly infects Ireland. So you have those revolutions in France. There's an attempted revolution in Germany. Yeah. Part of that tension that we were just talking about between the church and Young Ireland is the fact that there's Italian revolutionaries trying to overthrow
Garibaldi.
The papal state.
There's Garibaldi at the time, sure, of course.
Yep, so at the same time that the Catholic Church is condemning Young Ireland, they're also trying to recruit Irish parishioners to go to Rome and other papal states to try to put down these insurrections. Mm-hmm. So that is where a lot of that tension is coming from, is that you have these secular revolutions against, not just against Catholic Church, but against, you know, monarchy,
all of it,
Republican ideal that's sweeping Europe in 1848, and Ireland is certainly part of that at that time.
Even more so because of the oppression of the British, but it's a really, and some people, you know, they come out of the Enlightenment and they look across, but this is why this book, The Craft, is, I think, a really interesting book. is they look at these guys, but these guys get this notion, and it gets in. You know, I'm like a Robert Emmett Wolf Tone guy. You know, I'm I love that time period, and they saw themselves as free of the church and free of the crown. Boy, if that isn't Thomas Jefferson. But there was the oppression wasn't there, and I mean it's kind of the stuff that Jefferson and Adams and Washington and others are saying. Paul Revere saying that.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a lot of echoes at that time, and you had that attempted revolution in 1798 in the wake of in Ireland, in the wake of the American and French revolutions as well. And, I mean, the thing that's so interesting, when the Irish try their revolution in 1848, this is right in the throes of the Great Hunger. You know, people are just trying to survive.
Dying,
trying to launch a revolution at this time, which ultimately dooms it to failure with the timing. But they weren't willing to wait any longer, even with the odds against them. But that had been the Irish way. Odds were... Irish, the odds were always against you.
That's the. I love what you said about the dedication to me in the book about not these Irishmen, but because, and again, a great lesson of our Second Amendment, the British outlawed the Irish having weapons. And if you read the history of the United States in the Jim Crow South, first place where implement gun control is recently freed slaves are not allowed to have weapons. You know, They weren't allowed to have guns. Well, the British outlawed any of the mix, and so then comes the rising of the moon and the pikes, and that's one that's in the middle of the 19th century when they rise again, right?
Yeah, so that's at 1848.
Yeah,
Young Ireland Revolution. Yeah, they they are literally at nighttime they're hiding away, going to places and forging these pikes that they're going to try to go into battle with. So
yeah.
I mean. Yeah, they're massively outgunned and don't have the weapons to pull this off either. So that's just another factor that's going to doom them to failure in 1848.
Then finally, and I'm going to come back to the thrust of the book, but I'm going to spend some more time with this. I was in Ireland before the pandemic hit, and it was my second time into the post office on O'Connell Street, and it's really changed. But when they were willing to die, you know, that really is a moment, isn't it? When they're willing to die. And the 16 Easter, the Monday after Easter Sunday. And they rise. And it's doomed. Yeah. They almost know it's doomed, don't they?
They do. And that's the thing that sort of echoes through my book and Irish revolutionary history is, they're doomed to fail, but they're absolutely doomed to fail if they don't try.
Indeed.
And the failure is not the unsuccessful revolution. The failure is not even trying the revolution in Irish eyes.
Indeed.
Because they take this attitude, and it's at the close of my book, when we're talking about the Easter Rising, there's a quote in there from one of the Irish revolutionaries that, to paraphrase, basically, we need to honor the failure along with the success.
Yes.
Because if people are going to be afraid of the failure, then they're never going to rise up.
I love that line.
Then we will never then be successful.
I love that line.
The Irish really put the effort into trying to honor the attempts and all. I mean, you think of, you mentioned like Emmett Wolfetone, Hugh O'Neill, all these legendary figures in Irish history, and they were never successful in casting out the British, but they're still heroes.
I've read volumes, I shouldn't say volumes, but books about the speech from the dock, where they would rip open their shirts and bare their breasts and tell the British lords what they thought of them, and they were doomed, they were going to be hung. Whereas what did the British say? They were going to be lifted, or the Irish said they're going to be lifted. And they just keep coming, and that's this brilliant part of history that I love. Christopher Klein's with us. That it's the wheel that turns and repeats and repeats and repeats and it repeats, and whether it's Afghanistan or Southeast Asia or Ireland. And I have a theory that I've read from other people. Toynbee writes about it. Anywhere the English have been, problems remain today. What do you do with that?
Well, I think part of it's got to learn that history behind it. I think that needs to be reckoned with and needs to be understood. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's learning from history. And part of what doomed the English here in 1916 is they didn't learn their history.
Yeah, they didn't.
They executed the leaders of the Easter Rising.
That's right.
And it was another military failure, just like every revolution had been before that. But they made it a political success by executing the leaders, making martyrs out of them.
I think everything
that comes to history is we've got to learn it.
No, we don't. I mean, the great line that whether it's Southeast Asia or Afghanistan or Ireland, you don't have to win, you just don't lose.
Yeah.
And you don't beat a birth rate. And the Brits thought that even now in Pakistan or India or Palestine, or you can just pick these spots, and you can. That's Afghanistan's the classic.
Oh yeah.
And Ireland eventually, they'd had enough, and they go home. Everybody goes home. And there's something about that, the IRA when by the way, I didn't know that they called it the Irish Republican Army in this country when they go to Canada.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things to me. In researching, the Irish Army that invaded Canada calls itself the Irish Republican Army, and they're wearing green uniforms and have IRA buttons on.
I did. I mean, I just went, wait a minute, hold on. I thought that came along, you know, with Michael Collins and De Valera and those guys, but apparently not. They were the IRA invading Canada.
Yeah, and their sister organization in Ireland, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, that's established in 1858, that's a through line.
Yeah.
They're the ones that launched the Easter Rising in 1916.
Yes, they're the ones
who are involved in the troubles in Northern Ireland.
The troubles.
60s, 70s, and 80s.
You've seen Black 47, I bet.
Actually, I haven't seen that one. No.
Man. And then they flipped it. They did Black 74 now about the British in Northern Ireland in Belfast. And it's just as frightening. But Black 47, Black 47 is a must-see.
Okay.
Let me do a quick turnaround. Our guest is really tremendous. He's been with us before, Christopher Klein. To give people an idea, you know, like, and I will come back and look at it again, that what they were doing, what the British were doing, anywhere the British have been in the world, anywhere, what they leave behind is problems. And anywhere, sub-Saharan Africa, India, Pakistan, what's now Bangladesh, Asia, Middle East. You know, read the life of Lawrence. Our friends at Urban Lights, they're Colorado's largest lighting showroom. Actually, looks like an art gallery. It's 20,000 square feet. Newly, and the lighting designs, monthly brilliant designs, fresh styles. The place is truly beautiful. My favorite parts of shopping. And I got two new light fixtures. We got them. I took my grandson. We all go. See the latest LED lighting innovations, incredibly wacky shapes, designs. The technology has brought you to the market. Check it out. Really is a fun experience. Urban Lights, owned by this guy, David Nestor. And we've become pals. A lighting business for over 40 years. Take advantage. Walk in. You will be amazed. And this is a March makeover sale. 40% off already the low prices. And selected ceiling fans are the gift. The home decor. You got to walk through it. It's the best. Find them south of I-25 on Santa Fe, between Florida and Mississippi. South of I-25 on Florida, Mississippi. Online, urbanlightsdenver.com.
News Talk 710 KNUS. Listen live at radio.com. We now return to the Peter Boyles Show.
It's a Wednesday morning, everyone, but it's St. Patrick's Day. It's March the 17th, 2021. A little music in the background. What can you do but fight or drink? I love culture. We were talking about it. There it is. Windy and cold, 38 will be the high, 50 tomorrow and 55 on Friday. Our guest is wonderful. He's always got a welcome dare here. Christopher Klein is with us. Twin Aspen Dental, tomorrow's my day to finish up on teeth, getting my teeth cleaned. And I'm going back out and see the doc, Dr. Richter. My dentist, my family dentist, we trust him. Pandemic or not, keeping people, employees and patients, everybody safe, the community safe. It's their top priority. They treat every patient. Top-notch infection control protocols keep their team and patients safe regardless of the procedure. If you want to experience the same quality of care that my family has experienced, join in. Right now, the door kicker is free teeth whitening for the rest of your life. Woo! Twin Aspen Dental, full-service dental clinic that has the best. Take care of the smallest cavities to total dental makeovers. Be confident in your smile. Become a new patient today. And free teeth whitening for life. Free teeth whitening for life. He is the man. It's the place. It's standalone. TwinAspenDentalCenter.com. 303-841-7466. 303-841-7466. 303-841-7466. Online, TwinAspenDentalCenter.com. Our guest is wonderful. His name is Christopher Klein. I think this is my third book of his, When the Irish Invade Canada. And I want to wrap up some things. I just finished Griffiths, a biography of Michael Collins. And at the end of the world, the First World War, and Woodrow Wilson is spouting off and about they're going to have, you know, small nations and all the insanity that never really happens. It wasn't Michael Collins. Who goes to see, who was it, De Valera or Tom Clark or somebody goes to Versailles to pitch, maybe it was the Americans, the three Americans that they hire, and the three Americans go, they're Irish Americans, they go to see Wilson at Versailles to ask for independence for Ireland as they're granting independence. And because of Lloyd George, they turn him away and the war begins again. And I, when you read the life of Ho Chi Minh, Ho goes to Versailles to see Woodrow Wilson, and they turn Ho away. History, again, such a sad thing to read, but nothing to learn from, question mark. So here's Ho Chi Minh trying to see Woodrow Wilson, and De Valera goes to America and raises money. Yep. You write about De Valera going to America.
Yep.
And they went to see Woodrow Wilson, and he, because of Lloyd George and Winston Churchill, they would have none of it. Speak to that.
Yeah, so De Valera, so he's sort of the preeminent figure in 20th century Ireland, so he's there during the Easter Rising, and he's there to shake John F. Kennedy's hand when he visits Ireland. Manages to escape prison after taking a wax imprint of a key that he swipes from the priest in the prison, and they end up smuggling it out, and they smuggle a key into a cake, and De Valera manages to escape out of this prison, makes it to America, and he's touring America. He's filling up Fenway Park here in Boston with about 50,000 people coming out to see him, sort of just rousing the Irish spirit. But, of course, you know, from a geopolitical angle, you know, he's taking on the powers of the world. And as you mentioned, we're meeting in Versailles. And, you know, he's going to be able to raise money, but getting the true object to get any sort of international backing for Irish independence is one that he's going to have to butt heads up against and going to lead to that war for independence in the ensuing years.
And then they send the black and tans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was Winston Churchill and Lloyd George. And as they, there's so many great books about the time of the tans. And they send the black and tans to Ireland. And if they just would have, I mean, it's like this moment. If you just would have done this, how different things would be.
Right. Like
they're colonials. They're imperialists. They are racist. And they see it for what it is. And they will not let the Irish go free.
But I mean, that's exactly what happens is that colonial, and Ireland's really the first British colony.
Absolutely.
And they're the ones that one of the last to leave too. You know, so that's how deeply that they've got their claws into Ireland because they've had it for so long. Plus they've, by transplanting populations over there, were able to, you know, plant the Protestant Church and Scotch-Irish, and of course we're still living with the results of that transplantation that happened 300-400 years ago in Northern Ireland.
It's horrible. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible history, and the British did it everywhere. They did it in South Africa. They did it in the Middle East. They did it in India. They did it in Pakistan. They did it in Bangladesh. They did it in Hong Kong. They felt this. They did it during the time of the Raja, and it's disgusting. And people want to not look at that for what it is, but what they did in Ireland is unforgivable.
And that's the attitude that many Irish have today.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's part of we talk about learning from history. I think it's part of what makes the Irish people remarkable, too, is that how deeply held the history and the culture is. And you feel that when you go to Ireland, too. I mean, that's, it's the island of saints and scholars for a reason. And part of it is they evolved in reaction to the subjugation that they were under for centuries.
That's all true. And then in the end, what do you do with Michael Collins? I just finished Griffith's bio of Michael Collins. What do you do with him?
Well, I mean, he's such an interesting figure.
Man.
I mean, part of it is, it's tough. It's interesting when you sort of view these historical figures and then you have the natural tendency to try to think of how it would be viewed in the modern context today. And you just think about how what made Michael Collins such an interesting historical figure is just by sort of infiltrating Dublin Castle, which was
spies.
The seat of British rule there, and basically getting the list of who were the spies and having that one day where the IRA goes out and kills all of them and takes it right to the heart of the British government was such an audacious move, which is celebrated in a lot of Ireland. I mean, you start to think then, all right, is that in a modern day, how is Michael Collins viewed if he, the assassinations of British officials?
There's a line, if I could, there's a line that I adhere to. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Exactly.
And nobody can, I've heard people, though it's not true. Of course it's true. Michael Collins, I could build the case, is the father of modern terrorism.
Well, I can even go back a little bit earlier, too. So an interesting figure, Jeremiah O'Donovan Ross.
Another one, yes.
So in the 1880s, more or less starts sending sleeper cells from Brooklyn, where they make dynamite bombs, send them across into London, and they bomb Victoria Station, House of Commons, and a pub next to Scotland Yard, which ends up working because in the explosion, it destroyed the intelligence that they had against Irish revolutionaries. Yeah. And, it's sort of flipping modern history on its head when you start thinking about having a terrorist, depending on how you view it, sleeper cell in the United States exporting violence abroad. Exactly what you're saying.
When I know this because of reading the Tans, when the British finally take the Tans out of Ireland, Christopher, do you know where they did with them? They sent them into the Middle East. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Then the British government used the Tans in what they called Palestine. And they're brutal. I mean, I'm getting the biggest bang out of watching the royal family flop around like a fish on the dock because of this idiot Prince Harry. But, what was the great line you had when Victoria slipped on the step, the Irish IRA? Somebody took credit for it. Tell that story.
That was Jeremiah O'Donovan Rosso. So, I mean, not only is he saying, they'll take credit for anything. So Queen Victoria slipped on the steps, and he claimed that the IRA put the lard on the steps for her to slip on.
Eventually, as people say, everybody leaves Afghanistan. They leave Ireland. Why did they finally leave? In the end, why did they leave?
Well, I think it's the wake of World War One. I mean, I forget what the quote is that I've gotten when the Irish invaded Canada from one of the Irish revolutionaries. It always said that basically Ireland would be successful at their revolution when England was preoccupied by another war. And that's pretty much what happens after World War One is that, it's right in the heart of that the Easter Rising occurs. And I think World War One just is the history where you sort of having the British empires kind of start to crumble at that point, and you have the United States gaining the ascendancy and becoming the dominant world power, and that plays a part of it, that you just have such, the stomachs aren't there for another, for colonial wars in the wake of the war that you had in Europe, where so many are killed in that trench warfare. So England's still trying to get itself back together after World War One. So that really gave them the point, that really gave them the turning point there. But it also really going back to the fact that in past, when we talk about when the Fenians invade Canada, one of the British who were ruling Canada, they court-martialed prisoners, sent them to death row, but they didn't execute. And the movement eventually died out, and they don't take that lesson with the East Rising. By executing those leaders, they are creating martyrs, and that is really what becomes their fatal mistake.
Who's the guy that they cured him, they wounded him, and then they put him in a chair? He was so sick, and then they still shot him.
Yeah, right.
That's Tom Clark.
One of the seven, if it was Clark or not. And Clark was a naturalized American citizen.
Yeah, that was Tom Clark.
Also. But, yeah, they execute those seven leaders, and that just changes everything.
You know, it's interesting when you read the history post the Second World War, and I'm a Lawrence fan. I read everything I can about Lawrence, and all these figures, and you know, when you read about African American soldiers coming back from the Second World War and then heading into the Jim Crow South, they go, wait a minute, I just went to Europe, I went to Asia to fight for somebody's freedom, and I come back here and they step on me. And then all those colonial soldiers from sub-Saharan Africa who go off in the British Army and come back, whoa, hold on, time out here. You know, you told me we're going to fight for to free the Belgians or the French, and we come home, and you treat us like we're being, like we are. And they rise. But they all kind of look at the Irish for the rising, too, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, there's a great affinity to this day when you look around at different areas of the world that were colonized by the British. Mm-hmm. And there is that connection to Ireland. And I think I was just listening in to Mass the other day, and they're, I think priests were talking about one of the papal nuncios that was sent to Ireland recently was from Nigeria.
Yeah.
And in Nigeria, I think they said that the patron saint of Nigeria is St. Patrick.
I mean, I read and that too, and I said, wait a minute, but apparently so, yeah.
So there is this real connection through a lot of African, Middle Eastern countries to the Irish from similar shared experiences that they went through under colonial rule.
The line of Michael Collins, what do you want? Michael Collins says, I want you out of my country. Hang on, let me do a quick turnaround. I love this guy, Christopher Klein. Groundbreaking advanced FUE treatment from Advanced Hair Restoration, finally here in Denver, and it works. You got receding hair, you got a bald spot, you got thinning hair, it's you. And Dr. Tanya Pauls is the surgeon. There's highly experienced teams and state-of-the-art technology, the best of the best. Advanced FUE treatment takes one day. It's pain-free. Your new hair starts growing the very next day. It's 100% guaranteed. Advanced Hair always received the very highest standard of care, well beyond CDC guidelines. Look at their website. A lot of before and after. AdvancedHair.com, AdvancedHair.com, AdvancedHair.com. It's easy. AdvancedHair.com. You can see before and after, or you can talk to them. It's private. It's confidential. It's so safe. Just take a look. Make up your mind. Tell your son, your daughter-in-law, rather, for your husband, your dad, your brother-in-law. The grand opening's here. Great deals are available. 720-459-HAIR, 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 AdvancedHair.com.
We now return to the Peter Boyles Show.
Morning, everybody. Wednesday morning, another St. Patrick's Day I will remember, March the 17th, 2021, 38 cold, but that's a little warmer, milder tomorrow, and the weekend looks great. Wonderful guests. We get them back as often as we can. And again, I talk about it, but I guess it's been over a year and a half now. Actually, I got it a year ago, November. It was then it was called Free TV. Now it's called Streamwise Solutions, and the website is called Get Streamwise Solutions. The phone number is 303-794-8600. Right now, you can watch every NCAA tournament game on HD, plus all your other favorite shows. If you're a basketball person, get them to come today and install. High-speed internet, plus HD TV, $70 a month. I have this system. And like I said, I watch it, and I don't know how it works, but it does. March is TV madness at Streamwise Solutions. And there's this wonderful old films that The Quiet Man will be on. It's like a must. Any new install in March, get one room installed for free, $100 savings there. But overall, just cut the cord. Saving 2 G's a year every year since I got Streamwise, but the service is just the best ever. Enjoy the games, watch what you want to, feel great about what you're paying for. Streamwise Solutions does their thousands of customers the best. Free quote, see how it works, I guarantee it. Get Streamwise, that's the web, getstreamwise.com, getstreamwise.com, or 303-794-8600, 303-794-8600. Final couple of minutes, we're getting back to actually talk about the book because we talked about Irish history, and he's Irish historian Christopher Klein. You know, there's a, we're talking about these theories of history and people that, you know, the Toynbees and you, Trevor Ropers and others, and they have these sayings that say, there is no tomorrow. It's only yesterday repeating itself. And Ireland was one of the places they pointed to. There was no tomorrow in Ireland. It was Ireland repeating itself. Afghanistan, there is no tomorrow. The Palestinians, and that there is no tomorrow. It's just yesterday repeating itself. And you can go around the world and find these places. And what do you do with that statement? Although Ireland is now somewhat not so much changed, but there was no tomorrow for 750 years, just yesterday repeating itself. Christopher,
right. And that's part of plays into this story about when the Irish invaded Canada, because you had repeated attempts to have these revolutions in Ireland. And the initial plan for when the Fenian Brotherhood, which forms in the United States in 1858, is that they're going to raise money and weapons and send it to Ireland to do another revolution. But after a few years, the idea is that this is crazy. You know, why are we trying the same playbook over and over again? Let's go to Canada, which was a British possession at the time. We can just get on a train, be there overnight, and hit them at the closest spot to us. Let's try something different and see if that works. So, I mean, that legacy of the history is something that plays into this story, too.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by Irish history. As I said, you know, growing up like we did and genetically linked to it. But it's a great sadness, isn't it?
There it is. I mean, that's probably part of where, you know, the poetry and the songs, where that comes from. Yeah. I mean, it's part of the duality of the Irish spirit is that, you know, you try to have that optimism, but certainly there's that sorrow that is the undercurrent. And it's the sorrow and the guilt, I mean, too, when you... it was talked about the Irish who came after the Great Hunger to America had that survivor's guilt.
Yeah. Pull that down a little bit, Billy.
They had this.
This morning, my nephew is in Boston, who's a brilliant young kid, sends me a picture of James Joyce and Beckett and an unknown woman walking together in Dublin in the 20s. And James Joyce looks so much like my father. It's amazing. And the tie-in is there. There's Joyce and Beckett and some woman, and they're walking in Dublin. We'll get you back. I'll put you on hold so we can rebook Christopher Klein, When the Irish Invaded Canada. Happy St. Patrick's, man. You've been a great gift for the show and a lot of good hours of reading. Thanks, Chris. Thanks a lot, man.
No problem.
On hold, buddy. All right, everybody, that's it. See you tomorrow morning, and we'll knock down and drag it out one more time. Take care of yourselves, everybody. Happy St. Patrick's Day. This one we will remember, I hope. 38 to high today, mild tomorrow. Take care.